The teacher of Christianity acts like a person who promises to restore patients to bodily health, but who prevents them from consulting skilled physicians, by whom his ignorance would be exposed. Christians weave together erroneous opinions drawn from ancient sources, and sound them before men as the priests of Cybele clash their cymbals in the ears of those who are being initiated in their mysteries. A few years ago, he began to teach the doctrine, being regarded by Christians as the Son of God. He invented his birth from a virgin, and was disgracefully born in a certain Jewish village. Of a poor woman of the country who gained her subsistence by spinning, she was turned out of doors by the carpenter to whom she'd been betrothed, having been guilty of adultery, and that she bore a child to a certain soldier named Pantera. That after being driven away by her husband and wandering about for a time, she disgracefully gave birth to Jesus, an illegitimate child, who, having hired himself out as a servant in Egypt on account of his poverty, and having there acquired some miraculous powers, on which the Egyptians greatly pride themselves, returned to his own country, highly elated on account of them, and by means of these proclaimed himself a god. Seeing you are so eager for some novelty, how much better it would have been if you had chosen as the object of your zealous homage someone of those who died a glorious death, and whose divinity might have received the support of some myth to perpetuate his mystery. Why, if you were not satisfied with Hercules or Aesculapius and other heroes of antiquity, you had Orpheus, who was confessedly a divinely inspired man who died a violent death. How much more suitable than he would have been Jonah in the whale's belly, or Daniel delivering from the wild beasts, or any of still more portentous kind? You mock and revile the statues of our gods. But if you had reviled Bacchus or Hercules in person, you would not perhaps have done so with impunity. But those who crucified your god when present among men suffered nothing for it, either at the time or during the whole of their lives. And what new thing has there happened since then to make us believe that he was not an impostor, but the Son of God? If the Christians would be willing to answer my questions, which I do not put as one who is trying to understand their beliefs, for I know them all would be well. But if they will not consent, but say, as they usually do not ask questions and so on, then it will be necessary to teach them the nature of the doctrines which they affirm, and the source from which they come. Why should it be he alone, rather than innumerable others who existed after the prophecies were published, to whom the predictions are applicable? The Christian believers, like persons who in a fit of drunkenness lay violent hands upon themselves, have corrupted the gospel from its original integrity to a threefold and fourfold and manyfold degree, and have remodeled it that they might be able to answer objections. Chaldeans are spoken of by Jesus as having been induced to come to him at his birth, and to worship him while yet an infant as a god, and to have made this known to Herod the Tetrarch, and that the latter sent and slew all the infants that had been born about the same time, thinking that in this way he would ensure his death among the others, and that he was led to do this through fear that, if Jesus lived to a sufficient age, he would obtain the throne. But if, then, this was done in order that he might not reign in his stead when he had grown to man's estate, why, after he did reach that estate, did he not become a king? Instead, the Son of God, wandering about in so mean a condition, hiding himself through fear and leading a miserable life up and down. Jesus, having gathered around him 10 or 11 persons of notorious character, the very wickedest of tax gatherers and fishermen, who had not acquired even the merest elements of learning, fled in company with them from place to place and obtained his living in a shameful and importunate manner. Well, let us believe that these cures, or the resurrection, or the feeding of a multitude with a few loaves, from which many fragments remained over, all those other stories of a marvellous nature were actually wrought by him. These are nothing more than the tricks of jugglers, who profess to do more wonderful things, and to the feats performed by those who have been taught by Egyptians, who, in the middle of the marketplace, in return for a few obols, will impart the knowledge of their most venerated arts and will expel demons from men and dispel diseases and invoke the souls of heroes and exhibit expensive banquets and tables and dishes and dainties having no real existence and who will put in motion, as if alive, what are not really living animals, but which have only the appearance of life. Since then these persons can perform such feats, shall we, of necessity, conclude that they are sons of God? Yet how many others are there who practice such juggling tricks in order to deceive their simple hearers, and who make gain by their deception? Or do you imagine the statements of others not only to be myths, but to have the appearance of such, while you have discovered a becoming and credible termination to your drama in the voice from the cross, when he breathed his last, and in the earthquake and the darkness? But that when dead he rose again, and showed the marks of his punishment, and how his hands were pierced with nails. And who beheld this? A half-frantic woman, as you state, and some other one, perhaps of those who were engaged in the same system of delusion, or, which is most probable, one who desired to impress others with this portent. One who was a god could never flee or be led away as prisoner, and least of all could he be deserted and delivered up by those who had been his associates. The disciples of Jesus, having no undoubted fact on which to rely, devised the fiction that he foreknew everything before it happened. How is it credible that Jesus could have predicted these things? And how could the dead man be immortal? What god or spirit or prudent man would not, on foreseeing that such events were to befall him, avoid them if he could? Whereas he threw himself headlong into these things which he knew beforehand were to happen. How is it that, if Jesus pointed out beforehand the traitor and the perjurer, they did not fear him as a god and cease the one from his intended treason and the other from his perjury? In the next place, those who were his associates while alive, and who listened to his voice and enjoyed his instructions as their teacher, on seeing him subjected to punishment and death, neither died with him, nor for him, nor even induced to regard punishment with contempt, but denied even that they were his disciples. Whereas now, you die along with him. Judaism, upon which Christianity depends, is barbarous in its origin. They deserve credit for their ability in discovering true doctrines, but the Greeks are more skillful than any others in judging, establishing, and reducing to practice the discoveries of barbarous nations. The Jews, then, leading a grovelling life in some corner of Palestine, and being a wholly uneducated people, who had not heard that these matters had been committed to verse long ago by Hesiod and innumerable other inspired men, wove together some most incredible and insipid stories, that a certain man was formed by the hands of God and had breathed into him the breath of life, and that a woman was taken from his side, and that God issued certain commands, and that a serpent opposed these and gained a victory over the commandments of God, thus relating certain old wives' fables, and most impiously representing God as weak at the very beginning of things, and unable to convince even a single human being whom he himself had formed. They speak, in the next place, of a deluge, and of a monstrous ark, having within it all things, and of a dove and crow as messengers, falsifying and recklessly altering the story of Deucalion, not expecting, I suppose, that these things would come to light, but imagining that they were inventing stories merely for young children. The more modest among the Jews and Christians endeavour somehow to give these stories an allegorical significance, although some of them do not admit of this, but on the contrary, admit that they are exceedingly silly inventions. The first point relating to the Jews which is fitted to excite wonder is that they should worship the heaven and the angels that dwell therein, and yet pass by and neglect its most venerable and powerful parts, such as the sun, the moon, and the other heavenly bodies, both fixed stars and planets, as if it were possible that the whole could be God, and yet its parts not divine, And I think that it makes no difference whether you call the highest being Zeus, or Zen, or Adonai, or Saboath, or Amuan, like the Egyptians, or Popeyes, like the Scythians. It is not probable, however, that they enjoy God's favour, or are loved by him differently from others, or that angels were sent from heaven to them alone, as if they had been allotted to some region of the blessed. Moreover, their cosmogony is extremely silly. The narrative of the creation of man is exceedingly silly. Perhaps Moses wrote these words with no serious object in view, but in the spirit of the writers of the old comedy, who have sportively related that Proetus slew Bellerophon and that Pegasus came from Arcadia. Moses and the prophets who have left to us our books, not knowing at all what the nature of the world is and of man, have woven together a web of sheer nonsense. By far the most silly thing is the distribution of the creation of the world over certain days, before days existed. For, as the heaven was not yet created, nor the foundation of the earth yet laid, nor the sun yet revolving, how could there be days? And after accomplishing so much on the first day, to do so much more again on the second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth. And after this, indeed, he is weary, like a very bad workman who stands in need of a rest to refresh himself. Christians at first were few in number, and held the same opinions, but when they grew to be a great multitude, they were divided and separated, each wishing to have his own individual party. Being thus separated through their numbers, they confute one another, still having, so to speak, one name in common. These things are stated much better among the Greeks than in the scriptures, and in a manner which is free from all exaggerations and promises on the part of God, or the Son of God. You see how Plato, although maintaining that the chief good could not be described in words, yet, to avoid the appearance of retreating to an irrefutable position, subjoins a reason in explanation of this difficulty, as even nothing might perhaps be explained in words. Plato is not guilty of boasting and falsehood, giving out that he has made some new discovery, or that he has come down from heaven to announce it, but acknowledges whence these statements are derived. This saying, "It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God," manifestly proceeded from Plato, and that Jesus took the words of the philosopher. Certain Christians, having misunderstood the words of Plato, loudly boast of a super-celestial God, thus ascending beyond the heaven of the Jews. And in all their writings is mention made of the tree of life, and a resurrection of the flesh by means of the tree, because, I imagine, their teacher was nailed to a cross, and was a carpenter by craft, so that if he had chanced to have been cast from a precipice, or thrust into a pit, or suffocated by hanging, or had been a leather cutter, or a stone cutter, or a worker in iron, there would have been invented a precipice of life beyond the heavens, or a pit of resurrection, or a cord of immortality, or a blessed stone. Now what old woman would not be ashamed to utter such things in a whisper, even when making stories, to lull an infant to sleep? Certain most impious errors are committed by them due to their extreme ignorance, in which they have wandered away from the meaning of the divine enigmas, creating an adversary to God, the devil, and naming him in the Hebrew tongue, Satan. Now, of a truth, such statements are altogether of mortal invention, and not even proper to be repeated, that the mighty God, in his desire to confer good upon men, has yet one counterworking him, and is helpless. The ancients do allude obscurely to a certain war among the gods, Heraclitus speaking of it. Pherecydes, again, who is much older than Heraclitus, relates a myth of one army drawn up in hostile array against another, and names Cronos as the leader of the one. The Son of God is punished by the devil, and teaches us that we also, when punished by him, ought to endure it. Now these statements are altogether ridiculous, for it is the devil, I think, who ought rather to be punished, and those human beings who are tricked by him ought not to be threatened with chastisement. Let us pass on to another point. They cannot tolerate temples, altars, or images. In this, they are like the Scythians, the nomadic tribes of Libya, the Seres, who worship no god, and some other of the most barbarous and impious nations of the world. But they charge those with folly who do so because, as I conjecture, they do not, like the Greeks, suppose the gods to be of the nature of men. God is the God of all alike. He is good. He stands in need of nothing, and he is without jealousy. What, then, is there to hinder those who are most devoted to his service from taking part in public feasts? If these idols are nothing, what harm will there be in taking part in the feast? On the other hand, if they are demons, it is certain that they too are God's creatures, and that we must believe in them, sacrifice to them according to the laws, and pray to them, that they may be propitious. Behold, the Christians say, I go up to a statue of Jupiter and Apollo or some other god, I revile it, I beat it, and yet it takes no vengeance on me. Do you not see, good sir, that even your own demon is not only reviled but banished from every land and sea? And you, yourself, who are, as it were, an image dedicated to him, are bound and led to punishment and fastened to the stake, whilst your demon, or as you call him, the Son of God, takes no vengeance on this evildoer. To some, the gods have appeared in visible forms. The world is full of such instances. You surely do not say that if the Romans were, in compliance with your wish, to neglect their customary duties to gods and men, and were to worship the Most High, or whatever you please to call him, that he will come down and fight for them, so that they shall need no other help than his? For this same God, as yourselves say, promised of old this and much more to those who served him, and see in what way he has helped them and you. They, in place of being masters of the whole world, are left with not so much as a patch of ground or a home. And as for you, if any of you transgresses even in secret, he is sought out and punished with death. Surely it is intolerable for you to say that if our present rulers, on embracing your opinions, are taken by the enemy, you will still be able to persuade those who rule after them, and after these have been taken, you will persuade their successors and so on, until at length, when all who have yielded to your persuasion have been taken, some prudent ruler shall arise with a foresight of what is impending, and he will destroy you all utterly before he himself perishes. If only it were possible that all the inhabitants of Asia, Europe, and Libya, Greeks and barbarians, all to the uttermost ends of the earth, were to come under one law. But anyone who thinks this possible knows nothing